Good evening and welcome to tonight's program. Thank you for being here tonight. My name is Cynthia Miyashita. I'm a volunteer here. I serve as chair of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum. And it's my pleasure to welcome Ethan Casey tonight, who's going to share with us his experiences of Pakistan. Before I introduce him, I'd like to encourage those of you who are not members to join us. And if you're a new member, we hope to see you here often at the club. I would like to tell you about a couple upcoming events. On June 15th, we're going to welcome journalists for the New York Times, Boston Globe, Atlantic Monthly, and Mother Jones, who will Bonnie Tsui. She's going to speak on America's Chinatowns, a people's history. She takes an affectionate, attentive look at the Chinatown that has bewitched her since childhood when she eagerly awaited her grandfather's return from the fortune cookie factory. Tsui visits the country's four most famous Chinatowns, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, Honolulu, and makes her final stop in Las Vegas. Tsui captures their stories, delving a deeper look into what Chinatown means to its inhabitants. So that's coming up in a couple weeks on June 15th. On June 29th, we're going to host Asby Brown. He's an author, architect, professor, and director of the KIT Future Design Institute in Tokyo. He's come out with a new book called Just Enough, Lessons in Living Green from Traditional Japan. A glimpse into Japan's past teaches that just enough may be the key to going green. Around 200 years ago, during the Edo period, the Japanese confronted the same issues that society faces today: limited supply of energy, water, materials, food. Their solution was to take just enough from the world. Come learn about a mentality that can serve as a blueprint for greener living today. Brown takes us behind the scenes, revealing the complex and ingenious techniques that put Japanese traditional life in harmony with nature. So I hope you'll join us for that as well. That's June 29th. At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Ethan Casey. He is the author of Alive and Well in Pakistan, A Human Journey in a Dangerous Time, which Ahmed Rashid, author of Taliban and Descent into Chaos, has called magnificent. Pakistani novelist Mohsin Hamid calls the book the insights of a singular, clear-eyed, and humane traveler. His latest book, Overtaken by Events, A Pakistan Road Trip, recounts a six-week overland trip he made in early 2009, beginning in Mumbai, India, in the early aftermath of that city's terror siege and ending in Karachi, Pakistan. The book humanizes Pakistan and Pakistanis for a global readership and offers compelling perspectives on events during a volatile period in a chronically volatile country. He is a frequent speaker on Pakistan at venues ranging from the Royal Geographical Society and the Pakistan High Commission in London to World Affairs Councils from Anchorage to Pittsburgh. He has used his experience as an American traveler and author with 15 years' exposure to Pakistan to help foster historical and geographical perspective, human connections, and conversation between Americans and Pakistanis. A few days after the New York Times Square bomb attempt, Ethan published an article which is called Some of My Best Friends Are Pakistani. It generated a lot of web traffic, huge interest. You can read it on his website, aliveandwellinpakistan.com. Ethan's first discovery of the world outside the United States, a trip to Haiti at the age of 16, spurred him to spend an academic year on the University of Wisconsin College Year in Nepal program and later to move to Bangkok. He interviewed Aung San Suu Kyi in April 1996 during her brief period out of house arrest. He was an eyewitness to the July 1997 coup in Cambodia. He interviewed Megawati Sukarno-Putri, who later became president of Indonesia, during the last period of Suharto's rule. He interviewed Corazon Aquino on the 10th anniversary of the overthrow of Ferdinand Marcos. He's always in interesting places at the right time, it seems, or interesting times. And he was in Kathmandu for the fall of the first elected government of Nepal after the 1990 anti-royalist revolution. We thank him for joining us today from Seattle and sharing his experience on Pakistan tonight. Would you please join me in welcoming Ethan Casey?
Thank you. Thank you, Cynthia, and thanks to all of you for coming tonight. I have a presentation based on a slideshow presentation based on the trip that I took to India and Pakistan last year, which I'm going to show you tonight. I was going to do a slightly different presentation, but in a way, this is a nostalgic journey for me tonight because it's. Maybe the last time I'll show this particular version of this presentation. I've been giving it for a year plus, and I think it's time to start mixing it up. But I haven't given it in a while, and it's a nice reminder to me of the trip that I took, which was from, as Cynthia said, from Mumbai on the coast in India all the way around to Karachi on the coast in Pakistan. Now, I apologize for not having a map with me to show you. I should. But if you look at a map, you'll see that the shortest distance between those two cities is actually across the water. You can't get from one to the other overland without going a long way around. There's only one legal land crossing between India and Pakistan. That's a border crossing called Atari on the Indian side and Wagha on the Pakistani side in the Punjab, up between Amritsar and Lahore. And I've crossed there several times. And this is where I crossed on the trip I took last year. And I traveled with a Seattle-based friend named Pete Sabo, who's a very good amateur photographer. And all these pictures are Pete's pictures. We traveled overland on principle, because I believe in traveling overland. I believe that journalism, properly done, is done on the ground. I can do journalism by phone or email with the best of them, but I think that journalism, as I understand it to be done properly, should be done the hard way, which is traveling, going to where people are, going to where events are, listening carefully to people who are going through the stories that one is reporting. My job as an international journalist is to go to where the stories are happening and try to bring a credible and helpful version of those stories back to the public who's reading me, which largely in my case is a Western public. I think that what a journalist can and should do is to try to enhance the understanding of his or her readership rather than writing only from the comfort of the categories that people bring to the subject. So you have to take the assumptions that readers are bringing and try to stretch them or challenge them in ways that will help them to understand better, even if that takes them out of their comfort zone and into a place that's less comfortable for them. And I hope you'll see what I mean when I narrate the slideshow. And if you don't, then please ask me, and I'll try to tell you more of what I mean. I had the good fortune to spend a lot of time in Pakistan in the 1990s, back when the Western public really wasn't noticing Pakistan much. There was a back-and-forth political situation between Benazir Bhutto's party, the Pakistan People's Party, and the Pakistan Muslim League led by Nawaz Sharif. And that was happening in the 90s. It was in the aftermath of the Afghan war against Russia, the war in Afghanistan that pushed the Russians out and I think eventually contributed very substantially to the fall of the Soviet Union. And it was in the aftermath of the military dictatorship in Pakistan of General Zia-ul-Haq. So there was civilian-led, what we call democracy, in the 90s in Pakistan. And lots of back and forth, lots of messy stuff, but it wasn't particularly considered to be of great interest to the American public. And in a way, I was fortunate to be there then because I experienced Pakistan and listened to Pakistanis as a young reporter from a position of innocence. I really was just showing up there, not really knowing much of anything, and saying, "Hi, I'm some young guy, young white guy. Tell me about your country." And I learned a great deal during those many visits I made in the 90s. So you fast forward a few years. I was living in London, and I got an email from a Pakistani friend saying, there's this new university starting in Lahore in the fall. Do you know anybody who might like to spend a semester teaching there? And I said, well, yeah, of course. I know somebody who'd like to spend a semester teaching there. And I signed up. And that was a great experience. That was the fall of 2003 into the spring of 2004. Now, I landed in Lahore 2 years to the day after the World Trade Center attacks. And because I'd been to Pakistan in the 90s, maybe because I'm a little bit contrarian and a little bit still naive, I showed up and spent 5 months living in Lahore, had another great adventure. But the world situation was different, and the kind of attention the world was giving to Pakistan had changed. But because I'm a special case who never takes anybody else's word for things, of course, I insisted on going to see for myself. And because the world was noticing Pakistan in a different way, I was then in a position to pitch a book to a publisher. So I pitched a book to this publisher in London, a good small independent, medium-sized independent publisher called Vision, and they went for it. They gave me a contract to write my first book, which was called Alive and Well in Pakistan. And that book covers the period from 1994, when I first went to the Indian-held side of Kashmir, till 2004, when I left Lahore after the 5 months I spent living and teaching there. But it doesn't cover it in a newsy way. It's not a book of hard journalism. It's a book of human stories, personal narratives, stories of conversations with my students, with the servants at the guest house I was living in, with people I met on buses, with people I sought out, a few well-known people, but mostly ordinary Pakistanis, people I met at cricket matches in the general enclosure, which is the cheap seats. That was a great adventure in itself. I was the only, white guy for a long ways, and I was a special guest of all these young guys in the general enclosure, and I wrote very fondly about one particular cricket match in my book. So I'm very happy to have had the chance to give cover the human dimension of my own experience of Pakistan over a decade in that first book, Alive and Well in Pakistan. And I think that is needed. That kind of writing about Pakistan is needed, because that's not the kind of book that gets written about Pakistan. A lot of books about Pakistan are all about what should U.S. policy be, or what about nukes, or Islamic fundamentalism and nuclear policy and things like that. And all those things are real. They're important, terrorism. But there's a lot of other stuff that goes on in Pakistan, including the humdrum, ordinary stuff of daily life. And I think that also deserves attention. And it behooves us as Americans to be reminded that that's a big part of the story. People are suffering from electricity shortages and inflation and things like that. My good friend Todd Shea, whom I'll mention at the end of the slideshow, says that the American public hears 2% of the story about Pakistan 98% of the time. So what I'm about is telling some of, to the extent I'm able, some of the rest of the 98% of the story. I had so after I had published that book, I had lunch with a literary agent in New York, and I was trying to impress him with something I had in mind, some other project. And I told him I'd written a book about Pakistan and published it. And he said, what's your argument? And I was really taken aback. I was like, well, I had never thought about that before. Again, in my innocence, I didn't know what to say to him. But then I, of course, how you always think later about what you should have said. And what I should have said then was, I don't have an argument. I'm not making an argument. I'm telling a story. If I have an argument, it's implicit. So the other thing I say along the same lines is, I don't do policy recommendations. That's not what I'm about. I'm about telling stories. So I went, that's also a cop-out, I understand, but I'm happy to talk about policy if you have questions, but I do try to avoid making policy recommendations. Other people are happy to do that. I went back in 2009 with Pete Sabo. I was going to make a documentary film about Pakistan. A couple of friends and I had a very ambitious plan to make a documentary We tried really hard to do that. Several things happened. We were fundraising for it. We didn't have any experience. We also didn't know how to develop a budget or, you know, whom to employ to make the, you know, do the filming and stuff. We were, again, very naive and inexperienced. But we were saved from the fiasco of actually making a documentary by a couple things. The Marriott Hotel in Islamabad was blown up by a truck bomb in September 2008. And that and other things that were happening around that time delayed our visa application. Pete and I had applied for journalist visas because we thought it's best to be above board and, you know, be totally open and upfront. I'm not sure that it was best, actually, to be, because the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, sat on our applications for 2 months until I had to pull lots of strings and call in high-level favors from high-level friends of mine to get our visas approved, finally. And then while that delay was happening in the fall of 2008, Mumbai was attacked by terrorists and besieged for 60 hours in this horrific incident in late November 2008. And because of the delay, and we weren't able to travel in November because I actually had a speaking engagement booked that I wasn't prepared to renege on in Denver that month. So we weren't able to, in order to delay our trip, we had to delay it until the spring. And while we were delaying the trip, the Mumbai terror attack happened. So, and then, of course, the global economy melted down. So then it was a lot more difficult to raise $300,000 or $500,000 to make a documentary. So what you can do a lot cheaper and a lot quicker than making a documentary is you can write a book. So we went in the spring of 2008, late February 2008, almost exactly 3 months after the Mumbai terror siege, and I just decided, okay, it's just too much trouble and expense to do a documentary. I know how to write a book. Let's do that. And I took Pete along with me. We included 32 pages of photos in the new book and lots of photos for other purposes, such as this slideshow. And we were going to go originally only to Pakistan. I thought I'm a Pakistan guy. I want to go. I want to get an update. I hadn't been to Pakistan in 5 years at that point. And a lot of things had happened in those 5 years, the lawyers movement, the remarkable lawyers movement for the restoration of a legitimate independent judiciary, Musharraf's declaration of a state of emergency, the elections that happened in February 2008, and, of course, amidst all that, the shocking assassination of Benazir Bhutto. All those things had happened since I had last been in Pakistan, and when I had been there in 2004, it was a relatively quiet, stable time. So I found myself telling audiences in the U.S., people would ask, you know, what's it like there now? And I would have to say, well, 5 years ago it was, you know, I haven't been there in 5 years. And, of course, that didn't sound very credible after a while, so I thought, well, it's time to go back. And because of the Mumbai siege, we decided we had to go to Mumbai first, and we had to include India in the trip. So the trip became 6 weeks, 3 weeks in India, 3 weeks in Pakistan, and we traveled entirely overland, Mumbai, Hyderabad, Deccan in South India, and Delhi, and then up through Amritsar, across the border to Lahore, and then we traveled along the Grand Trunk Road in Pakistan to Islamabad, and then back to Lahore, and then to Karachi for a week at the end of the trip, entirely overland. And we wanted, as part of the India portion of the trip, we wanted to do a couple of things. We wanted to hear Indians. I believe strongly, as I said earlier, in listening, that listening is really the first function of a journalist. So listening to Indian people, listening to Pakistanis, listening to Indians express their worries and fears about Pakistan and even their bile towards Pakistan, and just recording that, and then doing the same with Pakistanis, of course, and also seeking out, in particular, Indian Muslims to ask them, what's it like to be a Muslim in this society, and how do you as Indian Muslims feel about Pakistan? So that's the structure. That was really the theme, overarching theme and purpose of the trip. This is the Taj Hotel in Mumbai. one of the scenes of the horrific siege of November 2008. That dome was on fire. This lady is Maruh Inayat. She's a television journalist. She's a Muslim, Indian Muslim. Specifically, she's a Kashmiri, and she spoke very eloquently to me about being a Kashmiri and how Kashmiris, their situation is much more political than it is religious. And I had known that from the many weeks I spent in Indian-held Kashmir in the 90s. But after 15 years later, she had a perspective on Kashmir as a Kashmiri that I found very interesting and an interesting corrective to my own, the things I had learned from 15 years earlier. She obviously is well taken care of by the Indian establishment, so you have to correct for that. She has a well-paid and prominent job as a news anchor for a channel called Times Now. But even so, I found the things she had to say about Kashmir and its situation compelling and very poignant. She also covered the Mumbai siege for the entire 60 hours. There were famous photographs of her lying on the ground reporting the siege as it was happening. And friends of hers, she walked in to a bar after the siege with some friends of hers and got a standing ovation just for walking in. And people were asking her for her autograph. And she said she found that a very surreal but strangely gratifying experience. Some of the photos included in the slideshow are just because they're beautiful photos, and I think this is one of them. This is in Mumbai, and it's included in honor of Pete Sabo, my travel companion and photographer. I told somebody, a lady in Pakistan asked me, didn't you bring a camera? And I said, no, I didn't bring a camera. I brought a photographer, which was great because as a writer, I don't want to have to worry about taking pictures. This is Tushar Gandhi. He's the great-grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. He's involved in international peace work. He works with an organization called Seeds of Peace, which brings Israeli and Palestinian youth together and also Indian and Pakistani youth. I found him a really interesting and thoughtful guy in his own right. I told him, and not only with intent to flatter, I told him that there is a resemblance if you look at him but with the Mahatma, if you just take off some of the hair and maybe 30 pounds or so. And he told his self-deprecating story. He said that he was speaking at a kindergarten one time in South India, and he was running late, and he finally got there, and the teacher went up in front of the class and said, children, the man that you've been waiting for is finally here. And he went up in front of the class, and one of the kids said, teacher, don't lie. That's a wrestler. That's not Gandhi's great-grandson. But I asked him, what would Mahatma Gandhi be doing and saying in today's world if he were alive? And he said he would be, the first thing he would be doing would be trying to undo the division between India and Pakistan. Even if that could not be done politically, he would try to bring the two peoples together on a human level, and that the second thing he would be doing would be working for peace in Israel and Palestine. This is Mahesh Bhatt. He's a well-known Bollywood film director and producer. And well-known, aside from his film work, he's well-known for having controversial views and views that are sympathetic to Muslims and to Pakistanis. One of his parents, I can't remember which one, was Muslim, and the other was Hindu. So he's a product of secular post-colonial India. And he's very outspoken and very forthright about his views and about his involvement in peace activism between India and Pakistan. He had been to Lahore recently when I met him in March of 2009. I asked him, again, perhaps naively, I said, what do you think about the election of Obama? And this is March 2009. Obama had been inaugurated in January. And his response, which I put in my new book, Overtaken by Events, a Pakistan Road Trip, was the black man in the White House is a yarn that the young people of America tell themselves in order to give themselves a happy ending. And I wasn't quite prepared to hear that at the time, but I put it in the book. and we'll see. Well, there it is in the book. This is, I met him at the, what's called the Muhurat for a film called Deshdrohi 2, 2611 War in Mumbai. Indians refer to the Mumbai terror siege as 2611, which is the date, 26 November 2008. And this film, which was a fictional film being made about within 3 months of the siege, it was the production was beginning of this film, about cops and security people busting the, you know, Kassab, the lone surviving terrorist, and it seemed to be pretty cheesy and maybe exploitative, but certainly was, as a journalist, glad to be on hand for its Muhurat. A Muhurat is the ceremony that people hold in Bollywood, not when a film is finished filming, but when it's beginning to film. So when it's about to begin filming, they rent a hall in a five-star hotel, and all the starlets and entertainment media show up, and everybody gives interviews, and there's lots of razzmatazz. And so Mahesh Bhatt was there to do what's called the clapping, which he takes that wooden thing and goes like that and says, "I hereby announce that this film is starting to film." So that's the Taj, the dome of the Taj Hotel on fire. This young lady, Indian, Hindu-Indian, Vida Somya, she, her family lives in Mumbai, and she had studied in Lahore at the same university where I had taught, Beacon House National University. She was a guest student, a study abroad student in an officially done program at Beacon House National University. She was there to study art. And her father, whom I found a remarkable man, said every Indian should go to Pakistan at least once in his or her lifetime. And he fully supported his daughter going there. And he said even though some of his own friends said most people go to Pakistan to study terrorism, and you're telling me your daughter's going there to study art. They were incredulous, but he is a remarkable guy. He had been, he was somebody with a very strong leftist background, Vida's father. And he had been, in his youth, had been associated with the Communist Party of India and was living in China, in Beijing, when the Tiananmen Square events happened in June 1989. And so when Vida was in Lahore in November 2008, and President Musharraf declared a state of emergency, and there was house arrest and lockdown of the city for a few days. Vida, of course, he was worried about her, but then he said, "You know, this is a good experience for you. I lived through this, and this will give you perspective on the way the world works, and you will be glad you had this educational experience." This is how we got around India, overnight trains, really the only way to travel in India. This is Mrs. Beg in Hyderabad, a Muslim lady associated with families that are very closely related to the Nizam, the former ruler of Hyderabad, which was a Muslim territory that was Muslim-ruled and Muslim-majority territory that was forcibly included in the Indian Union in 1948. And right in the middle of South India. Mrs. Beg was very talkative. She was a great godsend to a writer like me. All I had to do really was listen and write down all the funny and interesting things she said. One thing she said was that when she was giving birth, she was about to give birth to her second son, Irfan, in 1979. And right at the same time, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, of Pakistan, the president of Pakistan, was about to be executed by Zia-ul-Haq, the military dictator who had overthrown him in a coup in 1977. There was a concocted Supreme Court ruling against Bhutto on a trumped-up charge of murder, and then he was in fact later executed, and it was a big deal internationally. And Mrs. Beg said that the folk belief is that if a woman in labor give prays for anything other than the cessation of pain, it will be granted. God will grant her wish. And so her grandmother-in-law urged her to pray for Bhutto. And she said, "No, I'm not going to pray for Bhutto. I'm going to pray for my father because he's not well. I don't care about Bhutto." And this is a Ghazal evening, secular Urdu language poetry put to music, beautiful music. Mrs. Begg and her husband are part of a circle of friends who have one of these musical evenings every 2 months in a different home. It was really a beautiful experience. And you'll notice the men sit in one corner of this L-shaped living room, and the ladies sit in the other section. This is a Muslim girls' school that Mrs. Begg took us to in Hyderabad. And a view from the train, some of the greatest pictures and the most representative pictures I think you'll see from India are from trains, because trains are a very representative part of an Indian travel experience. And this is Delhi. We waited about half an hour to get this picture for the parrot to come out of the hole in the tree. That's at the Red Fort in Delhi. Pete Sabo, my friend and travel companion, he's a great, he has a lot of patience, which I think a good photographer needs, and he cherishes pictures of wildlife and animals, and he loves to go to places like Costa Rica and Alaska where he can take pictures of wild animals. And so these enormous, chaotic Asian cities were not really what he signed up for, but he ended up with that trip because he was a good sport and he went along with me. But what was charming and really delightful to me was that his eye always sought out the animals and the wildlife and the nature, even in the midst of all the pollution and traffic and everything. And this is an example of that. This is Afsha Anjum, who's an Indian Muslim journalist. She's a sports journalist. She covers cricket. She covers the Indian national cricket team. And I sought her out for a couple of reasons. She was a friend of some people I had met in Mumbai, and she sounded like an interesting person. And because she's Muslim, and also because when the Indian national cricket team traveled to Pakistan, toured Pakistan in 2004, she went there with the team and covered that tour. Now, that was a really, really big deal for anybody who remembers that, especially on the Pakistan side, and I think also on the Indian side. India had not toured Pakistan. The cricket team had not toured Pakistan in 16 years at that point. And when I unfortunately was not in Lahore anymore when the tour happened, but I remembered friends and students of mine saying, oh, that's not going to happen. They say the Indians are going to come this year, but they're not. Their politics will make it not happen. It's not going to happen. No, it's not going to happen. You could tell they wanted it to happen, but they were protecting themselves against the disappointment. But amazingly, it happened, and it was a love fest. By all reports, people in when India won the series in Lahore, people were going up and down in cars and trucks, Pakistanis celebrating and waving the Indian flag. And if people found out you were Indian, they wouldn't let you pay for anything in a restaurant. They would you know, shower you, smother you with hospitality and appreciation. And so it was really a wonderful experience for all concerned, I think, and Afsha experienced that. And she said, as a Muslim in particular, when people found out she was Muslim, Pakistanis would ask, well, what's it like for you? Are you okay? Are you all right in India? And she'd say, oh, everything's fine. And she would even exaggerate, say everything's even more fine than it was, just so people wouldn't worry and stuff. So she was really delightful, and I included a very pretty long extract from our conversation in the book. This picture doesn't need a caption or explanation, I assume. It's hard to take a bad picture of the Taj Mahal. This is there at the Taj. This is at the Golden Temple in Amritsar, the Sikh holy site. And just a couple of hours after that, Pete and I crossed the border, and in the right of this photograph is my former student, Adnan Latif, who insisted on meeting us at the border and driving us into Lahore. He had been eagerly waiting 5 years for me to come back to Pakistan, and it was great to see him. And he insists on pursuing a career in journalism, which I hope turns out well for him. The man in the middle in this picture is Aslam Mogul. He's a city planner. He's a city planner, someone who's concerned with housing and public transport. And he had a successful international career working with the UN and other international agencies. And then in 2000, he moved back to Pakistan. And one of the moving things he told me, unrelated to political things, was he said, Lahore really should have a decent public transport system. And where is the democracy when poor people and working middle-class people can't afford to take public transport, and there isn't a decent bus system to take people to their work? And yet, out in the outskirts of the city, there's all this land speculation in the suburban areas of all the Pakistani cities. Now, not to bring the point home to too much of a fine point, but that sounded rather familiar to me as an American. I think you in the Bay Area are fortunate to have relatively very good public transportation. Aslam also was an eyewitness to the Long March, which was the culmination of 2 years of what is called the Lawyers Movement. Now, in March 2007, President Musharraf illegally and very unwisely dismissed the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Iftikhar Chowdhury. And a lot of things ensued from that, I think ultimately including Musharraf's own downfall. And almost 2 years after that, on March 15th and 16th, 2009, some thousands of people were about to leave Lahore to walk to Islamabad, which is by road, by car, 4 or 5 hours from Lahore. So it would have taken quite a long time for them to get there. And by the time they got to Islamabad, I think it would have been hundreds of thousands of people. And who knows what would have happened in Islamabad if the Long March had actually been a long march and ended there. But there was a political standoff. And President Zardari, the widower of Benazir Bhutto, who by then was president, was refusing to reinstate the Chief Justice. And I believe that either the Americans or the Army Chief, General Kiani, spoke quietly to Zardari and said, you have to back down, and or the political situation just forced it. And he did back down and agreed to have Iftikhar Chowdhury reinstated. That was a historic victory for this great and very encouraging civic movement called the Lawyers Movement. Now, that's, of course, not the end of the struggle, but we don't hear enough about the Lawyers Movement and other very positive developments in recent times in Pakistan. And Aslam was an eyewitness to those events, and he was very excited. He said, this is the greatest thing that's happened in my country in my lifetime. These are the ball boys at the Lahore Gymkhana Tennis Club. And in my first book, I wrote a lot about all the tennis I played. My university was across the road from the Gymkhana, and I would sneak out at 3 o'clock every afternoon and play until sundown. And I was nice to the ball boys, so they liked me, and I would play with them and play tennis with them and stuff. And most of them were Christian, from the Christian minority in Pakistan. This is Pete Sabo's Pakistan. This is the toll plaza on the way from Lahore to Islamabad, a typical view of Islamabad from the Markala Hills above the city. It's a planned city built on a grid system by Greek architects in 1960, very atypical of an Asian city. The Faisal Mosque, built with Saudi money in the 70s, this is representative, I think, not to say that a mosque is a bad thing to build, it certainly isn't, but the pernicious influence of Arab oil money and the bargain with the devil, so to speak, that Bhutto, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was the first to begin making on Pakistan's behalf with Arab money and power, that's still having a bad influence in the region and in the world to this day. This is the Red Mosque in Islamabad. It was the site of a famous Waco-type siege between the Pakistan Army and militants who were holding hostages inside it in the spring of 2007. It's being refaced with new bricks that are not red so that it can't be called the Red Mosque anymore. This is on the way up to Murray, which was a British-era hill station outside Islamabad. It was a cold, rainy day that day. That's Pete next to me in the blue shirt. This guy on the right, he was sitting there waiting for suckers to come along, and he would charge 20 rupees a picture. And we took several pictures, then he multiplied the number of pictures we took by 20 and tried to charge us like 200 rupees, and we had, of course, had a discussion about that. But he smacked the snow up into the air so it would look like it was snowing when the picture was taken. And we ran into this family along the road. I wanted to capture, when I put this picture in the book, I wanted to capture it, a Pakistani family on the road in Murray, but thought better of it. Ghazala Manella is a member of a remarkable family that's been politically active and that's been affected severely by Pakistani politics for several decades. Her father was a justice on the Supreme Court that voted to hang Bhutto in the concocted trial of 1979. He was personal enemies with Bhutto. And Zia-ul-Haq, the military ruler who wanted to hang Bhutto, appointed Ghazala's father to the Supreme Court because he believed that he could be safely relied on to vote to hang Bhutto. But he refused. He said, "This is a kangaroo trial. You are cooking this up. This is not legitimate law. I refuse to vote." To hang this man on such flimsy evidence. I don't like the guy, but he didn't commit this murder. And he was one of the four judges in the 5-4 split decision, one of the four who voted against hanging Bhutto. And for having done that, he was forced to take his family into exile in England. And he died in exile. Ghazala's mother is English. She's still alive, and she's a remarkable lady as well. And Ghazala, now, if you fast forward 20 years, almost 20 years, I met her and her husband and her other relatives and celebrated Eid, the festival at the end of the fasting month of Ramadan, with them in their village in the Northwest Frontier Province, and got to know them, wrote about them at some length in the first book. And then in the meantime, in the 5 years between the publication of Alive and Well in Pakistan and my return to Pakistan in 2009, Ghazala and her husband, Atar, became prominent leaders of the lawyers movement. So if you go back to archived articles about the lawyers movement in the New York Times during these past several years, Atar Manila is quoted many times as a spokesman for the Chief Justice, Iftikhar Chowdhury. And when I sat down with Ghazala in 2009 and asked her all about this, she told the story of how he became involved with the Chief Justice and a little bit about the Chief Justice personally and why and how she and others admire him, and why she and many others were willing to go out on the streets and get themselves beat up by cops and arrested during this movement. She showed me many pictures of herself, including one of blood streaming down her face because she'd just been smacked by a cop's baton. A really, really remarkable person, and some of the most remarkable and admirable Pakistanis I've met have been women, most of them probably. Another of whom is Fauzia Manella, who's Ghazala's sister-in-law. And Fauzia is a historic preservationist and an artist, and she's very activist about art and about historic preservation, and she believes that the CDA, the Capital Development Authority in Islamabad, is trampling over lots of historic things, and she's all about going around outside the outskirts of Islamabad documenting wonderful old things that need to be preserved or at least remembered as they're being obliterated by development and by stupid political and corrupt business decisions. This is a historic train station built by the British during the colonial time, and this is a that sign is from the British time, and basically it says The especially the blue panel on the right shows a Hindu, Muslim, and Sikh all drinking tea, and it essentially says, no matter what religion you are, it's okay to drink tea. It's not against your religion. So the successful marketing of tea in the subcontinent. These are the Buddha caves outside Islamabad, another site that Fawzia writes about in her book, Glimpses into Islamabad's Soul. These are Buddhist sites with Buddha images on them that are still barely visible, but that have been that have really suffered badly from neglect and abuse because people don't appreciate them. And one of the things I did made a point of doing on this trip was, or in the last 2, 3, 4 years that I've been back living in the States, I've gotten to know a lot of Pakistani communities around the U.S. There are certain centers where the Pakistani community is prominent and very active, and the South Bay and the East Bay is one of those centers, and Chicago is another, Houston is another, and then L.A. and Orange County, New Jersey. There are certain places where Pakistanis live, especially, but they're really all over America. And any place you go from Wichita to Indianapolis to Albuquerque, there are some Pakistani physicians. So I've gotten to know this community rather well, and I've gotten to know its nonprofit organizations, the very admirable nonprofits that support healthcare and education work in Pakistan in order to make life better for Pakistanis, especially the younger generations growing up there. And I think very much purposefully, as part of that purpose, working against terrorism. Because if you give young people hope and self-respect in the form of education and jobs, then perhaps they will be much less inclined to blow stuff up. So one of those organizations is called Developments in Literacy. And it was founded by a woman in Orange County named Fizza Shah. And I had met Fizza at an event in Pasadena when I spoke a year and a half ago there. And meeting her and getting to know about her organization, I decided I should visit one of the sites that she, where DIL, D-I-L, Developments in Literacy, runs a school. So this is at a village called Goof outside Rawalpindi, which is near Islamabad. DIL in Urdu also means heart. So it's a bit of it's a pun or an acronym. And this is the road. As the road gets less navigable as you go towards the village, it's a difficult sort of 2 hours from Rawalpindi, but actually not that far, but hard to get to by road. This is the school in Goof. And the woman on the left is from the DIL office in Islamabad, and she took us on this day trip to the village and the school. This is the previous school building before the new one was built, and this picture I include also because it's one of those that I consider to be a really beautiful printable Pete Sabo original photo, and this one as well. This man, Dr. Bugyo, was Benazir Bhutto's speechwriter when she was prime minister in the 90s. He's a Sindhi, which is the same ethnic group that Benazir came from. And he's very elderly now, I think in his 80s, and he was the friend of the guy who invited me to spend the semester teaching at the university. And he's now living in retirement in government retiree housing in Islamabad. And I was really moved to spend a couple of hours with him. Didn't expect to spend that long, but he's got lots of time on his hands and lots of great stories to tell. And as I parted with him, he said, you should look up my my son who lives in Washington, D.C. And I said, oh, can you give me his email address? And he said, oh, you should ask Issa, our mutual friend. Ask Issa for his email address. He knows about such things. I don't know about things like that. This is Faisal Ali Khan, who's a young businessman. He comes from a city called Dera Ismail Khan, which is on the border of South Waziristan. South Waziristan is where the U.S., the unmanned drones are being, are landing and killing women and children, even as they also kill some bad guys. But the fact of the drone attacks, if you don't know about the drone attacks, as I was shocked to learn a year ago that some Americans I was speaking to in Seattle didn't, if you don't know about them, you should. They're being done, as I understand it, they're not officially acknowledged as happening by the U.S. government, but everybody knows that they're happening. And they are having the effect of really alienating both the local people in the frontier and in the areas where they're landing, for obvious enough reasons, and also the general public in Pakistan, even people. There's a lot of ethnic division and a lot of mutual scorn between among different ethnic groups in Pakistan. And the Punjabis, who are the dominant ethnic group, they don't particularly like or admire the Pathans, who are the people who live in the frontier. There's an uneasy relationship there. But the Punjabis are offended that their sovereignty is being damaged by the drone attacks. The Pathans and the people who live in Waziristan are more than offended. They're hurt and killed by them. There's more to it than that, of course, too. And the part of the problem in Pakistan is that everybody has plausible deniability, and it's sort of designed that way. The Americans say that the Pakistani government should take responsibility. The Pakistani government can point its finger at the Americans. The Pathans and the frontier people can say, well, we don't like the Pakistani government, so we support the Taliban because they're against the Pakistani government. So everybody is to blame, I think. And I'm certainly happy to discuss that in the Q&A, but it's a much more complicated situation than I think you'll see portrayed in the American media. This is another of those beautiful pictures. This is along the Grand Trunk Road, which is a historic road built by an emperor in medieval times. Kipling called the Grand Trunk Road a river of life such as you will see nowhere else in the world. Rudyard Kipling wrote that 100 years ago, and it's still that. And this is a view of the Grand Trunk Road. Kipling wouldn't have known about the particular vehicles that are on it now, but he would have recognized the spirit of it. And it's exhausting but fascinating. We spent several days in a town called Karyan, which is halfway between Islamabad and Lahore. This is Tahir, who he's holding kulfi, which is a kind of Pakistani ice cream type thing. He was our driver and companion for several days. He works for a doctor who works and lives in Tacoma, Washington, who told me, you must go to my town, Karyan, and I'll set you up and my guy will be your driver and all this, Jawad Iqbal. The only problem with Tahir is whenever I had some, I wanted to do a certain thing, but he had gotten different instructions from Jawad, he would say, no, you can't do that. Dr. Jawad say you must do this. So, but Jawad is a friend of mine. This is Dr. Sitar, who is a cardiologist who works at a hospital that was founded by Jawad Iqbal in Karyan. Now, what's notable about this is that this hospital is in this town, Karyan, which is halfway in between Islamabad and Lahore. That means it's at least 2 hours drive from Islamabad in one direction and 2 hours drive from Lahore in the other direction. So if you have a heart attack or another severe health problem in Karyan, and you don't have access to, and which you don't typically have access to, good specialized medical care, you would probably die on your way to to a hospital in either of those cities. So Jawad Iqbal has set up a regular video conferencing over the internet over Skype that he himself and other doctors based in the U.S. donate their time to consult with doctors like Dr. Sitar on the ground in Karyan, and it has the effect of vastly improving access to health care for local people in this town. I actually witnessed Jawad saving the life of a man who had just had a heart attack just a few days ago when I was at his dinner in Tacoma, at his house in Tacoma for dinner. And I saw it from the other end when I was there last year. This is the hospital right along the Grand Trunk Road. This is a famous restaurant in Karyan where it's famous for its dal that's made with real ghee, real clarified butter, rather than with just any old oil. And you'll meet people all over Pakistan or America, and if you mention Karyan, they'll say, oh, that's where that great restaurant is. When we were kids, we used to go there stop there on family vacations and things like that. This is a brick kiln, very typical site in the countryside and in Pakistan and Punjab especially. Very typical picture, three guys on a motorbike with no helmets. This is the line of control a couple of hours outside Kania. It's not especially difficult to get to where we were taking this picture by road, but you can see the ruggedness and the beauty of the snow peaks. Those peaks are in Indian-held territory. The line of control is the de facto disputed border in the disputed region of Kashmir. This is the same area looking down into the valley. These boys were playing cricket at the line of control. These are the group of young the young film crew that we spent several days with and traveled with on that trip. And these are two of my former students back in Lahore, Adnan Latif on the left and Usman on the right. We had dinner at a famous place called Food Street. Basically, the brother of Nawaz Sharif, who's basically the dictator of Lahore, told all the food vendors a few years ago, you can't stay anywhere. You now have to go to this one street, and it's called Food Street. And it's now very famous. Another of my former students, Isla Dean, who's now an instructor at the same university, she very movingly said to me as we parted the day I was able to visit, she said, you were good for us, which I really appreciated being told. And of course, she and her classmates were good for me as well. This is Dr. Shanaz Khan in the pink on the right of this picture. She's a family practice physician in Zephyr Hills, Florida. She and her husband have lived there for 25 years, raised two daughters in America. One's now in law school, the other's in medical school. The younger generation of Pakistani Americans who are represented by people like Shanaz's daughters, these people are going to be U.S. senators and great leaders of America within the next 20 years. And they are remarkable, talented, energetic, amazing young people. They're going to be journalists, they're going to be physicians, they're going to be politicians. So the rest of us just need to start getting used to that. This is a view of Liberty Circle, which was the site of the... While Pete and I were in Mumbai at the beginning of our trip, there was an attack on the Sri Lankan national cricket team, which was in Lahore to play a match against the Pakistani national team. And it was a very disturbing incident where several terrorists wearing backpacks and wielding automatic rifles were really pretty much allowed to run free for quite a while. And there was a lot of question about who's in control of the police in Lahore. And I think that situation was affected by the national political situation at the time in Pakistan. But part of what was disturbing about that incident to me was that I heard about it by way of the Indian media. And Times Now, the TV channel that Maruk Inayat works for, their coverage was really over the top, very jingoistic, very... I think irresponsibly anti-Pakistan, anti-Muslim, used words like failed state, and really was kind of, I thought, trying to wish this incident to be like the demise of Pakistan. I'm afraid that's all too representative of the kind of coverage that the Indian media gives to Pakistan. But this is actually the view of the major roundabout where the incident happened. I'd spent a lot of time at this roundabout and the market that's nearby, Liberty Market, when I was living in Lahore before. And this is the view outside of a fourth-floor window where a 17-year-old boy who works in an office witnessed the events. And I interviewed this boy about what he had seen. A typical street scene. That's me and Adnan. We're on the balcony of a famous restaurant called Cuckoo's Den, which was started by the son of a prostitute in the red light area in the old city of Lahore. And this is a view from that balcony of the Badshah Mosque, the great Mughal-era mosque, which until recently, I understand, was the largest mosque in the world. Pete told me that this is on the way to Karachi by train. He told me it reminded him of home, which was Southern California. He said, it looks like home except for the occasional camel. street scenes in Karachi. And we ended our trip in Karachi. This is off the coast. There's a fishing village on an island off the coast, and we were able to spend a day there with Mahera Omer, who's the young woman in the white at the left of this picture. She's a documentary filmmaker. She said, I said, how do you make a living as a documentary filmmaker? She said, I don't. How I make a living is when Western film crews come to Karachi and they want to film political violence, and they hire me and other Pakistanis to go out and film it for them because they don't want to, they think it's too dangerous for them, but I make good money. But I don't make good money for my real work. She's also an animal rights activist. She founded something called PAWS, Pakistan Animal Welfare Society, and she rescues dogs from the street. She was an interesting, rather idealistic person. This is an ethnic Bengali crab fisherman who comes from what's now Bangladesh, or he was born here, but his family came from Bangladesh. He has no papers. He has no legal residence in Pakistan, but he spent his whole life there. And this is that same fishing village. And this is our last full day in Pakistan, driving into interior Sindh to a village. The young man in the green at the left of this picture is Aurangzeb Murray. His older sister is Minister of Information for the provincial government of Sindh province, and they're sort of the big family from this village, and he took us there to see Sindhi village life. I made this shot, and this picture gives just a sense of just how exhausted Pete and I were at the end of a six-week road trip. In the back of the picture with us is our friend Assam, Aurangzeb's friend as well, and I captioned this picture in the book Three Amigos. An education reformer named Sami Mustafa, we were able to spend time with on our last morning just on the way to the airport. And ending the slideshow, I want to end with this picture, which was not taken in Pakistan. It was taken in Yosemite National Park. And with me in this picture is Todd Shea, and I'll just spend a minute or two telling about him, and then I'm very happy to take questions or talk about politics or anything. But you'll have noticed that my presentation really is mostly not about politics, and for the reasons I explained at the beginning, That's purposeful. I want to. There's always going to be plenty of politics in any story that's told about Pakistan, but I think it's important to emphasize the other things that are happening there as well. So Todd Shea is an American who was a singer-songwriter on the verge of having commercial success. His managers had been involved in bringing the Beatles to America. And he was on the cover of some music industry magazines, and he was scheduled to play the nightclub, the famous CBGB nightclub in Manhattan on September 12th, 2001. And he woke up at his hotel on the morning of September 11th, and he saw the towers on fire. He took all his musical equipment out of his van, and he drove down to Chelsea Piers and said, "I have a van. How can I help?" And so he spent the next 5 days driving out to Brooklyn and Queens and going to places like Rite Aid and Walmart and getting supplies and things that the relief workers, the emergency workers, needed at Ground Zero. And from that experience came a new vocation for him, which was providing logistical support to medical and emergency relief workers in the aftermath of emergencies. When the tsunami happened, he went to Sri Lanka and spent several weeks there. Then the same year, later in 2005, Hurricane Katrina happened. He went and spent several weeks in New Orleans. And then he just got back to Maryland, where he's from, and he would sat down with his teenage son on the couch and turned on the TV and ordered a pizza. And the news on the TV was earthquake in Pakistan. So he called up the Pakistani embassy and said, "How can I help?" And he spent some weeks in Pakistan really doing amazing work and cooperating with the local people and with the Pakistan Army, which by all accounts really rose to the occasion and was crucial in the relief efforts after that earthquake, which killed 80,000 people. And then when the other relief workers all left the earthquake-affected area and moved on to other things, Todd decided it was time for him to stay. So he's been there for the last 4.5 years. He recently responded to, because he was in America doing fundraising for that work, he responded to the earthquake in Haiti and spent 6 weeks there, which is personally very gratifying to me because I have spent a lot of time in Haiti myself over the past 28 years. And I just now had the honor of hosting Todd for a week in Seattle. He spoke at the University of Washington and Seattle Central Community College, and I was able to arrange some meetings for him. And he's somebody who I think is not only a great example of what Americans and others can and should be doing in today's world to enhance both health and relations, human connections, but also a prophetic voice who speaks as a patriotic American to other Americans about what we as Americans should be doing and saying in today's world, in particular with reference to Pakistan and the Muslim world. So thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed the presentation. I'm here to talk to you as long as you'd like. Yeah. Good night.
American,
yep.
An American in Pakistan says you're going to have a target on your back. Then I read a couple days ago about the Lawyers Committee in Pakistan blaming Mumbai on an American conspiracy or something. And, you know, my wife called
that. Makes.
If you even think about going to Pakistan, you're nuts.
So I'm very fortunate that my fiance not only is indulgent about me going to Pakistan, but wants to go with me. So, inshallah, we will go next summer. And the danger is real, right? You do have a target on your back, I suppose, right? But Cynthia referred in the introduction of me that I was an eyewitness to the coup in Cambodia in 1997. Now, I was young and dumb then, but I had a rifle aimed at my chest during that incident, not because I was American, but because I was a nosy journalist going somewhere that I really shouldn't have gone, right? But so you take calculated risks, especially if you're a certain personality or if you're a journalist. You do it because it's what you do. But I have had only, I think, two moments ever in the 15 years I've been traveling to Pakistan where I felt in physical danger. One was on this last trip in Karachi a year ago. There was a little ruckus at an arts festival, and it was not religious at all, but it was politically, it involved politics. And I was in a very vulnerable position as a white guy and being put in this room where if the angry people had found me, who knows what might have happened. But those incidents have been rare. They can happen, but I think it's really, really important to go. For us as Americans, I almost would argue that we have a responsibility rather than let the fear keep us from going, let the curiosity and the compassion compel us to go and to make the connection. And the connection is made so much more effectively by going physically and saying, I want to know you. And the Quran said, there's a great line in the Quran where God says, I made you tribes and nations so that you might know one another. It's the same reason I go to Haiti. I go there, I say, I want to know you and who you are and what you're about. And if that entails a little bit of physical risk, then so be it. But maybe that's not for everybody. That's why guys like me write books so other people can, you know. There are very few. There are relatively very few hotel rooms in Pakistan. It's not really set up for tourism. It's a country. One of the great tragedies of Pakistan is that it never developed a proper tourism industry. And I argue that it would. That if it had developed a tourism industry, how much better would a place would the world be now, right? If Americans had gone there as Peace Corps, you know, people from the 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, until the present day, if tourists could go there and enjoy the beautiful mountains and the wonderful cultures there, if, you know, you don't have to go all the way down that road like Thailand did and really sell your soul to the god of tourism, which I think Thailand did. But you can go, you know, a third of the way down that road and really enhance the human connection and bring in hard currency. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, yes and no, you know. I think, so Pakistani people point out, I mean, Pakistanis are very good at sort of deflecting things. And there's a very disturbing fact that that guy is Pakistani, but he is also a U.S. citizen. You know, he's a naturalized U.S. citizen. The other thing he is he's a father of, what, two children, young father, who lost his job and has suffered because of the declining economy in the States. What if he had been a white guy in a very similar situation and tried to blow stuff up? We would have heard a lot about his personal and family situation. Instead, most of what we heard about him was that he was Pakistani and Muslim. And so Pakistanis deflect the situation from themselves partly by pointing that out, but they're right to do so. You know, and it's also right to say most of the Pakistani Americans that you will meet are not that guy. Todd Shea, just this past week in Seattle, he was saying, you know, I've 200 Pakistani American physicians went to Haiti to work with me during the 6 weeks I was there. 200 Pakistani American physicians. And they need to be acknowledged and appreciated as Americans and as human beings who responded to a tragedy in a place that, you know, ostensibly is not connected at all to Pakistan, but it's connected to humanity. Excuse me, Iftikhar, just one more thing I wanted to add. I was surprised, but I was not surprised. But I was in San Diego at the time that happened, and I woke up early that morning with this all in my head. I had just heard the news the night before. I looked at the morning news on the web, and then I threw aside all my other plans for the day, and I wrote that article that you mentioned called Some of My Best Friends Are Pakistanis. And I just put it up on my website, and I sent it out by email to all my contacts. And then it was republished on many other websites, and it became this phenomenon, I think. I think Pakistanis appreciated that I was willing to say, this is the Pakistan, and these are the Pakistanis that I know. That doesn't mean it's all good or that they're all good, but it does mean that they're not all Faisal Shahzad. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's a point well worth adding. I think we're all, you know, I tend to say we're Americans are on a learning curve since 9/11. We're on a very steep learning curve. We've taken a lot on board. And I think all of us, Americans, Pakistanis, everybody else, we're all traumatized, right? We're all like kind of still in shock. If you go through a physical shock or an injury or something, you know, it can take you, it's exhausting. It's emotionally exhausting as well as physically exhausting. Your body is trying to repair itself. A lot of other things, you don't have energy to do other things. You become distracted and drained. And I think we as a society, we as a, you know, global society, but in this country and certainly in Pakistan where they're on the front lines, people are in shock. You know, we're dealing with all this stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Question in my mind, and you
so to speak. Yeah. Yeah.
How widespread is that?
I think the short answer to that question is yes, Wahhabism was part of that deal, and yes, Pakistanis do see it as part of the deal. Pakistanis tell me, and with very good cause, that Islam in their part of the world, and you know, South Asia, was much more influenced by Sufism and much more esoteric and mystical and peaceful strains of Islam. And that has had to compete with this much more aggressive Wahhabism, which specifically comes from Saudi Arabia in recent years, really in, I say, the last 30, 40 years. And part of what that was about in the 70s when Bhutto, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was in power was money, right? Arab oil money. So we hear this a lot these days, any of us especially who are paying attention, a lot of it has to do with oil. We are addicted to oil. We get our oil mostly from Arabs. Arabs have all this money because of the oil that they sell to us. They take some of that money and they fund that mosque, Faisal Mosque, named after King Faisal of Saudi Arabia. Gaddafi Stadium, where I saw the cricket match in Lahore between Pakistan and South Africa, was named after Gaddafi, who was great pals with Bhutto. I think this actually goes back to the 70s, not even to the 80s in the Afghan War, but really the origin of the whirlwind we're now reaping goes back before that to the 70s and really a lot of it needs to go be laid at the feet of not Zia but Bhutto. And of course there's much more to it than that too. Yeah. Great grandson, yeah.
Could you run a circle of a country that has a huge military, nuclear weapons, and guns?
Yeah, I can't square that circle. No, sorry, I can't. I think Gandhi is. He's sort of honored in the breach, you know. He's like Jesus in the sense that people say they're for him, but they don't. Really, you know, Gandhi set a really high standard and walked a really hard road personally. And I think it would be great if everybody walked that a road similar to that, or even halfway as difficult as and personally demanding as the road Gandhi walked. But all the evidence of history tells us that most people aren't going to do that. So, actually, in the great American political novel, All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, there's a great line where Willie Stark, the main character, says, what folks claim is right is always a couple of jumps short of what they need to do business. And I think that tells you something. Thanks. Yeah.
Our thanks to Ethan Casey for being with us tonight. It's a wonderful slideshow, and thank you for sharing your experience and insight with us at the Commonwealth Club. I see you've brought some of your books, and I would imagine you'd be happy to autograph those for any of you. Thank you very much once again. Thank you all for joining us.